I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and today I'm going to be talking about a huge historical transition that took place after the Second World War. And there are examples of this in totalitarian societies and democratic societies around the world, and this really lasts until probably the late 1970s and early 1980s, it's ascendant until then. And that is the belief in centralisation and state planning. These are the sorts of things that people normally ascribe to the communist world, but there were clear structures and limitations and boundaries in place in liberal democratic capitalist societies as well. The Second World War had been a kind of a showcase for state planning. The war could not have been won by America, Britain and the Soviet Union without it. Interestingly, I was listening to an interview with the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis the other day, and his view was that after the Wall Street crash, Franklin Roosevelt, not a socialist by any stretch of the imagination, but a patrician, somebody who saw his job as managing capitalism, imposed the New Deal on America, introduced the New Deal on America to stop really capitalism devouring itself. And his argument, Varoufakis' argument, was that the New Dealers and the Soviet Union destroyed fascism in the Second World War. Obviously, Britain's involvement is there, but Britain, you know, midway through the Second World War, has become the junior partner, reliant on America, and also employs much of the same kind of state-directed control of the wartime economy. The normal economic laws that Britain has abided by for the last couple of centuries, between 1939 and 1945, are basically off. So today what I'm going to do is I'm looking at The Fear and the Freedom by Keith Lowe, which is a phenomenal book. And it really is about the kind of the long shadow of the Second World War. Keith Lowe's work, as I've talked about before, in Savage Continent, is really exemplary research. And I like, one of the reasons I like this book is it, much like David Reynolds' The Long Shadow about the First World War, is it looks at how the Second World War stays with us in culture and memory. So in his chapter 7 of the book, Planned Utopias, he writes, The scientific and technological innovations that took place during the war would never have happened without government involvement. The atomic bomb project was a perfect example of well-directed state power. The American government had set themselves a goal, poured money and expertise into reaching it, and had ended up with transforming the world. There were many other instances that were almost as impressive. In Britain, for example, the wartime government had imposed the world's most comprehensive system of food rationing. This had not only conserved vital food supplies during the war, but it also ensured that everyone, rich or poor, received a scientifically balanced diet. Despite terrible shortages of most foodstuffs, infant mortality rates actually declined in wartime Britain, as did deaths in the wider population from a variety of diseases. Such successes, bolstered by the great victory of the war itself, immediately raised the question, if central planning by state could bring triumph in war, could it not also bring triumph in peace? If old laissez-faire economics of the 1920s and 30s had led to collapse, depression, and ultimately to the war itself, was it not time for now for the state to step in and make sure that similar catastrophes would never happen again? And why stop at economic reform? Should the state use its power to make society fairer, more equal, and better for everyone? These were the ideas that were in play at the end of the Second World War. Fatefully, 30 years later, Milton Friedman, the architect, the intellectual theorist of monetarism, or kind of neoliberalism as we would think of it, said that what the most important thing about a crisis is the ideas that are lying around at the time. And that it is in moments of crisis that previously marginal ideas can suddenly become dominant or hegemonic ideas. In 1945, in the aftermath of the Second World War, the ideas that are lying around are statist ideas. And they managed to dominate the political landscape of Britain, Europe, America, Japan, and of course the Soviet Union until the mid-1970s at the very least. It is the crisis of the mid-1970s of inflation and oil shocks that begin to break apart the belief that the state has the answers or the state is capable of intervening successfully in economic affairs. And those laissez-faire thinkers who were marginal figures in the 1940s, the likes of Hayek and Ludwig von Mises and people like that, they suddenly find that they have a case to argue again, that as Ronald Reagan put it, the government can't solve problems, the government is the problem. So one thing that's worth remembering is that these were broadly mainstream ideas in the mid to late 1940s. The ideas that Sir William Beveridge put forward from 1942 onwards in the Beveridge Report of dealing with the five evils of poverty, ignorance, squalor, idleness, and illness. Well, Beveridge himself was, of course, not a socialist. He was a liberal. It's also worth pointing out he was a eugenicist before we kind of get all too emotional about the guy. But the Churchill wartime government passed under Rab Butler, later Macmillan's Chancellor, the Butler Education Act, which brought about comprehensive education for all children after the war, and the 11 plus and a kind of like a variated system for creating a managed future society, which would have manual workers, technocratic elites, and the sort of the managerial classes as well. So the idea of the state stepping in to reorder and restructure societies that don't work when you kind of leave them on their own was not a thing of the radical left. And indeed, Keith Lowe writes, in the idealistic atmosphere of 1945, the clamour for greater government involvement in society was impossible to ignore. In war-torn Europe, it was not only communists who pushed for state-led reform, but also many conservatives and Christian Democrats. In other parts of the world, the calls came equally from American New Dealers, from Asian and African nationalists, from Latin America's right-wing populists. Experts of all political persuasions, likewise, wish to harness the power of the state, from scientists like Britain's J.D. Bernal to America's Edward Teller to economists like John Maynard Keynes and Jean Monnet. All of these people believe passionately in the power of the state to transform our lives for the better. I suppose one thing that one can liken it to now is the broad clamour for some kind of international Green New Deal. When you read about the desirability of this in everything from the New Statesman and the Guardian, or the kind of the liberal left, through to the Times and the Financial Times and the Economist on the centre right, you start to realise that these newspapers all understand their readership. They all spend a lot of time polling and doing focus groups with their readers, and they understand that there is a broad consensus that states now must act, and it doesn't really matter how much money they throw at it, but they have to considerably. And you can see Biden in America heeding this. You know, he's not simply making a sop to the left. He knows that this is popular politics. So that is, to some degree, analogous to the kind of the consensus that was emerging after the Great Depression and after the Second World War, that states managing societies was no bad thing. However, Keith Lowe writes, and yet, as the war had demonstrated, there were just as many dangers in state solutions as there were benefits. Had not the belief in a strong centralised state also been one of the foundation stones of Nazism, Stalinism and Japanese militarism? Those who pursued state solutions to the world's problems could sometimes be quite fanatical, as could those who opposed them. In the aftermath of the war, the old arguments between those who believed in the sanctity of the individual and those who believed in the transformative power of the collective were resurrected. But it was the centralisers who now won out more than they had ever before, sometimes with quite startling results. One kind of countervailing tendency in all of this was the belief amongst many in the ashes of post-war Europe and Asia that utopias were possible at all. Theodore Adorno, that member of the Frankfurt School of Social Research and philosopher and critic, essentially said that, in a post-war Europe, as Tony Judd put it, it's built on the ashes of Auschwitz. The idea that you can have utopias, utopias themselves are entirely dangerous and suspect ideas, but that the future world you hope to build is already built on a kind of a mountain of bodies, and that the best one can hope for is something more realistic, a society that is perhaps permanently and healthily sceptical of the visions of others. Thinkers like Friedrich von Hayek, who wrote The Road to Serfdom in 1943, and who had lived in Austria through not only the Catholic fascism of Dollfuss, but also the Nazi takeover and the attempted communist coup, basically put forward a thesis that liberty could not be guaranteed by the state. In fact, the state would always be, to some degree, an enemy of liberty. And the less state intervention there was, so much the better.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
His theory went that fascism and communism could be explained by the advance of the state, the growth of the state, and that, in his view, even supposedly benign states, if they became too powerful, if they were able to tax and spend too excessively, if they were able to intervene in markets too readily, if they were able to nationalise, to build houses where private industry should do that, or to provide healthcare or what have you, inevitably totalitarianism would follow. As a theory of totalitarianism, it's obviously a weak one, even at the height of Britain's welfare state in the 1970s. There was no suggestion whatsoever that Britain was likely to become a totalitarian, a fascist, or a revolutionary socialist society. This is a nonsense. Hayek himself was interested in a particular kind of liberty, and really, when you get down to it, he's interested in the liberty of capital, the liberty of people of money, to be able to protect that money from the state, to move it where they saw fit. And the power of this idea really has reshaped the world after the end of the 1970s. The ability of capital to move where it likes now is one of the kind of the key features of the world that we face. It's one of the key aspects of globalization that emerged in the 1980s and 1990s. Once again, proving what Milton Friedman had said about the ideas that were lying around when crises came, and the period of kind of the advancement of the state broadly came to the end in the mid to late 1970s, when all of a sudden new ideas began to dominate political discourse. Partly because the channels of discourse, newspapers and TV shows, TV channels across the Western world were happy to disseminate this kind of stuff because of the people that tend to own those newspapers and TV stations. But anyway, to rewind and look at the post-Second World War period, in 1947, Hayek and collaborators set up the Montpelerin Society. The first meeting of a very fringe group of economists and philosophers who argued against the trend towards state provision of services, state provision, state intervention in the economy, powerful trade unions and a centrally managed society. This, they thought, would not be something that could they could get on the political radar immediately, but they were nothing if not patient, and they knew that it would probably take decades for this idea to fully establish itself. One reason why there was no chance of Hayek's ideas having any traction in 1945, 1955, or even 1965 was the scope of the damage in the aftermath of the war. For example, in Italy, 13,000 bridges had been damaged or destroyed as a result of the war. In Britain, bombing and V weapons had destroyed 202,000 houses and made another 255,000 uninhabitable. There is no free market solution for that. In France, 460,000 buildings had been destroyed and 1.9 million damaged. Germany had lost 3.6 million apartments, or a fifth of all dwellings in the country. The Soviet Union had seen all the major cities laid to waste, Kharkov, Kiev, Odessa and Minsk, but also 1,700 smaller towns and 70,000 villages. And of course, there was no chance of anything other than Stalinism ruling the Soviet Union, at least until the 1970s. In Poland, the entirety of Warsaw, for example, was razed to the ground. And the destruction of Poland arguably wasn't fully recovered from until perhaps the 1980s or perhaps even the 1990s. For example, the Kislev Rites. In the aftermath of the war, the country, Poland, was dismembered and then reassembled with parts of devastated Germany. Nobody knew how to estimate the number of houses or cities destroyed because it was not clear which houses or cities to include in the calculations. Such destruction, which was as bad in Asia as it was in Europe, took as enormous toll on the world's population. It was compounded by the massive displacement of populations that took place during the war. In 1945, there were around 9 million homeless people in Japan, 20 million in Germany, and 25 million in the USSR. Some estimates for China, although they can never be as much better than guesses, put the figure as high as 100 million. All of this was only made worse after 1945, when the world population began to suddenly boom, and when rural populations once again took up the long-term flight from the countryside into the cities. A lack of urban housing was therefore a truly global problem in the wake of the war. So whilst the trauma of the war and the losses of the war led many aspects of post-war societies to exist with this shadow over them, for some, for those who believed in planning, it was a rare and valuable opportunity. So perhaps the most famous architect of the 20th century, Le Corbusier, had seen it as an opportunity. Even before the Second World War, Le Corbusier, who had always argued that buildings were essentially kind of machines for living and working in, had hoped in his sort of wildest, most modernist fantasies that cities would be somehow torn down so they could be rebuilt from scratch, having grown like, you know, London or Hamburg or something like that in fairly random fashion since the early Middle Ages. Politicians generally tend to ignore people like that who want to recreate society from scratch, though the rebuilding of Moscow and the broadening of streets and the levelling of buildings in the 1930s comes somewhere close to that. But with so many towns and cities in ruins, writes Kislev, a complete redesign suddenly seemed possible. And in 1945, we have a moment where anything seems possible. And this is the curious thing, the fascinating thing about that historical moment, when around the world, suddenly everything seems to be up for grabs. Keith Lowe writes, rather than mourning the devastation of their cities, therefore, many architects and planners saw it as an opportunity they had been waiting for. Urban planning is often born of the canon, wrote one French intellectual as he contemplated the ruins of Brest and Lorient. Now, at last, these notoriously squalid French coastal towns could be rebuilt as grand ports worthy of the 20th century. Germany's Paul Schmidt-Henner and Konstantin Gutzow felt that the same way about Hamburg and Lübeck, and even went so far as to call their bombings a blessing, albeit one that was heavily disguised. In Warsaw, which was by far the most devastated city in Europe, architects like Stanislav Janowski enthusiastically joined the Bureau Obrodnicy Stolicy, the capital reconstruction office, knowing that only in this place, in this time, would they have, and I quote, a chance to fulfil their most magnificent dreams. Of course, the most optimistic country of all was Great Britain. The Blitz had been a planner's windfall, announced a British consultant in 1944. Not only did it do a certain amount of much-needed demolition for us, but, more importantly, it made people in all walks of life realise that reconstruction was a necessary. Other British planners wrote with enthusiastically of the chance to make a fresh start of Birmingham, to make Durham a city beautiful, and to turn York into a city of our dreams. Exeter, according to its planner Thomas Sharp, was a phoenix ready to rise renewed from its own ashes, and Plymouth could now be redesigned as a city worthy of her glorious past and present heroism. So this attitude is very, very prevalent in Great Britain. There is a belief that society and public spaces can be remoulded to make them more egalitarian, and that that should be the kind of the guiding spirit of the post-war era. And Britain was determined, the British government and large parts of British society were determined to plan boldly for the future. If the Blitz did it, wrote the American housing expert Catherine Bauer in 1944, then that explains the secret guilty regret deep within many American liberals that we missed the experience. I'm sure that most Americans didn't quite share their misplaced enthusiasm. So we'll dip back into the fear and the freedom at some point in the near future, because it's a fascinating journey through that moment of unbridled expectation and dreams for the future, dreams which, of course, inevitably are never fully realised. Anyway, thanks so much for listening today. I hope this has been useful and interesting for you. Do come and check out the website at explaininghistory.org, and come and find me at Patreon. There's going to be some new content going on Patreon pretty soon. And if you are able to drop by the Explaining History Facebook group, there's always something kind of interesting happening there. There's a bit more content on the Explaining History YouTube channel, but everything, if you go to explaininghistory.org, that's the kind of the central hub. All the bits and pieces of everything I do is there. Anyway, take good care, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.